Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women. Today I'm welcoming on a very brave woman. She was abused as a child, had a theatrical demanding mother. She's been bulimic and has attempted suicide. She is Adele Angelica Brewer, and she's written a memoir, 70,000 Camels, a motivational survivor's memoir. Hi, Angelica, welcome.
Hi, Josephine.
Just to say, let's start at the beginning. You're half Italian and half Spanish, brought up in Rome. Your childhood was very vivid. It was my favourite part of a book. Can you tell us about it?
I was born to a soprano singer, conservatorium trained. Father had apparently left when he found out she was pregnant. And she and my grandmother raised me in Rome. We lived not very far from the Vatican City. And I was an only child. And I pretty much, you know, looked after myself, really. I went to school. I did everything that everybody else did, but I wasn't receiving the maternal guidance from my mother that I craved and needed. So my grandmother actually stepped in to fulfill that role. So I actually looked upon my grandmother as my my mentor and my mother and father and everything else.
But your mother just really didn't know how to be a mother, and she was very cruel.
That's correct.
Why do you think she was?
Yes, she was very neurotic, very career orientated, and also it was a case of she wasn't mothered very well. Her father left pretty much when she was about 5 or 6, and as I talk about the family history, which kind of started during the Franco War, and my grandmother and my grandfather were both revolutionaries, harboring some of the people that were against the Franco regime, and that dissolved after she'd given birth to the first 3 children that she had out of the 4, and my mother was the second.
So, yeah, your mother was always trying to make it as a opera singer, but not doing very well, and you just seemed to really be in the way.
Yes, that's correct. Originally, and I heard this from her, my grandmother never told me that. Originally, my grandmother had actually pressed her to put me into an orphanage because she, as much as my grandmother was my mentor and had raised me, apparently she wasn't happy with her having a child because she was acting as the stereotypical stage mother and just wanted my mother to have a career and that's it. And she was basically at her heels the entire time, pushing her into areas of her career that to begin with weren't favourable to my mother. And I describe a few scenarios that my mum did tell me about, like the time that she had basically gotten a Spanish artist to do a nude of my mum, and she was only 15 years old, and that was all in order to get her into the artistic circle so that she could become a singer, which turns out to be a thwarted career that my grandmother actually wanted to pursue but was not allowed by her aristocratic family.
It's incredible, isn't it, how when you're a child and then when you're in your 20s and 30s and you start acting out and everything's terrible, you don't realise it's all because of a chain of events even from before you were born.
That is exactly correct. I should not have been there. I mean, my mother had fallen pregnant a few times before me and had terminated all her pregnancies. So I always wondered, you know, why the hell did you have to have me? You know, because she knew my father wasn't going to hang around. So it's almost illogical for her in the throes of her career with a stage mother to actually go ahead with this pregnancy. And that always... It always made me wonder why, you know. I mean, it could have saved me a lot of trouble throughout my life. I feel like I have a legacy that I carry, you see, and I find it very difficult to get past what I now call the curse, you know, because everything I try and everything I attempt to do, right up till today even, is always thwarted and is just riddled with problems and obstacles that I'm actually fed up with trying to overcome.
Yes, no, I bet. Now, because the house was sort of artistic and a bit unstable, some unsavoury characters ended up coming round and you were severely abused, and you describe it really well in the book. It's incredibly moving and horrible.
I made it quite clear in the book that I didn't understand what was going on. Mm. I welcomed it as a child because to me it was affection that I wasn't receiving from my mother or my grandmother. And I had to live with that, with the fact that I was actually complicit in the sexual abuse because I actually needed affection, and that's what I thought I was getting until it started to become violent, and that's when I realised it wasn't affection and that there was something terribly wrong with what we were doing. And that's when I told my grandmother, and then, you know, that's what kept happening basically. But at least after that first encounter, I realised that the other pedophiles were going to hurt me, so I managed to put it to stop that, not to bring it into my life.
Yeah, and you learnt to fight back, didn't you? That was the main thing. So why did you move to Australia then? You know, you're in Rome, the most cultural, beautiful place in the whole world, and then you end up in, not being rude, but Australia, where there isn't so much.
Yes, that's actually a really good question, because my mother, from the day she stepped into this country, was forever slandering how lacking in culture and finesse and etiquette it was, and yet she stayed, well, 45 years now, where she should have turned on a heel and gone
straight back
to Europe. Yeah. But the reason we came is that her career came to a standstill in Rome through a lot of poor career choices, which were, again, probably... how would you say, what I'm trying to think of the word, influenced by my grandmother, who didn't know anything about, you know, the world of opera, and also her own neurotic, my mother's own neurotic sort of stance on certain issues, social issues that she could have manipulated, but she didn't know how to. I had asked her at one time when, you know, things were, her career had long passed. I said, "Mum, was there a casting couch in the opera world?" And she said, "Yes, absolutely, it was rampant." And I said, in retrospect, should you have not taken advantage of that, and you would have got what you wanted, like a lot of other people and artists of that era that couldn't fight for their morality and their art. They just had to sleep with the right people. And she said, "No, I would never have done that." And then I said to her, "But you told me you had so many boyfriends and so many sexual encounters. Why, what's with one more that could have got you what you wanted?" And she said, "My religion told me not to barter, you know, my body for my career." And I'm thinking, but you bartered me. You made me suffer so badly that why not? Yeah, I would have supported it. I would never have judged her.
I think, to be honest, she sounds like unstable woman.
Oh, extremely unstable, extremely. And even now she's under some delusion. She's 84 years old and she's under some delusion that her real purpose for life is that she's heralded from the Catholic Church as a bringer of good news to the world about the Catholic Church, which is an institution that she shunned for many, many years by trying transcendental meditation and even Freemasonry and all sorts of, you know, delectable, weird dogmas. So, and yet she came back to the conclusion that the Catholic Church is the one and will always be the one.
No wonder at the beginning of the book you say, "I'm definitely don't approve of the Catholic Church." You have a brilliant singing voice. It was really noted at school and you were given quite a few opportunities which either you blew or your parents or your mother blew, said you couldn't do it. You know, lots of things were in your way to stop you. And I can relate to this. You put love affairs before your career, because I had the same thing. I didn't get attention from my family. So what you do is all you want is a boyfriend, a man, to kind of give you love, and you hope you'll get stability. And of course, you got married very young at 20, didn't you?
Okay, so the reason Reese came about was because the person that I was madly in love with would not commit to me because I was very unstable. I had developed and cultivated exactly the same neurosis and paranoia and anger that my mother had, because that was my way to own and fight and stand up for myself and what I thought I needed. So what happened was the first man, who was ironically was an Englishman, he would not commit. And so I thought, "Well, stuff you, I'm going to go find someone else." When I met Reese, it was while I was still dating the other man, and the way that I made a decision to stay with him was that my parents were being even more abusive than they had been when I was young, because I now had this detested stepfather that would chain me to the house, basically. And it was a choice of I either stay here chained to these two people, which I hate, or I go and go out with this guy that I don't love and make the most of that. So for me, and I was just talking about that today with my second husband, I thought I'd no options because I was so immature and so devoid of vision that I thought my only choice was either home or this man. And so, of course, I stuck with the man and I had to follow through with my built-in Catholic ethos that once you commit to someone and get pregnant to them, you can't dissolve the relationship, no matter how bad it gets. So that's how I came, you know, came to Reece, and how I stayed with him for 18 years.
And how bad did it get?
It got terribly bad, because I now recognise late in life that he was Asperger's, which is what my son is as well. And at the moment, as we speak, I came back from the hospital today because my son has been committed for under the Mental Health Act. So I'm having quite a bad day about
it. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yes, Reece was undiagnosed Asperger's. No, that's okay. I understand. And, you know, it was something that I have to get past until we can get him the help that he needs. But Reece was very, very abusive in terms of you couldn't get a word in, you couldn't flaunt your own individuality, you couldn't explore your individuality unless it was something that he wanted. And of course, me being so combative to try and, you know, be heard throughout my entire life since I was a little girl, instead of, you know, submitting to him, which we would have had peace if I did, I would fight toe-to-toe at every turn to be heard and be in an individual and have my say. And, of course, that became escalated into domestic violence.
I'm so sorry. But you did have three lovely children. That's a good thing about it, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
And my daughters in particular are the most wonderful. They're so inventive and kind and loving and super talented. And Eden is as well, but unfortunately his autism and his anger issues, which is basically through DNA inheritance, has taken from both me, my mother, his father, and that's why he's in the mental health facility at the moment, because he's extremely destructive, self-destructive and threatening to other people.
I'm so sorry. So he's the fallout, really. I mean, that's the trouble. It's like, as we said, it goes from generation to generation. Now, how did you manage to get out of the marriage, and what was your next move after this?
Well, the point of no return was when, and I know I have to be blunt, I hope you don't mind with your listeners for me to say this, but when I knew that I could no longer sleep with that man one more night, that's when I thought, I've got to get out, because if I don't get out, I'm going to take my own life, because I can't stay. And that was the turning point. And so I developed a lot of courage through actually going online and talking to other people. My daughters actually set that up for me, because they could see the struggle that I was going through, and I thought I was trapped because I had no hope. No one was giving me, and therefore I sought it through the world of online chat. And through the feedback that I was getting, even from other men, I decided that I could do this. So then I just took the plunge and left him, which was in itself probably a year of absolute trauma, where I even second-guessed doing it. I thought it would be better to have trauma with him than the trauma that I'm suffering now by leaving him, because he wouldn't let me go. So he was accessing resources like government bodies, you know, and that kind of thing to stop me from leaving him. So he was going to child protection services and saying that my son was being abused by someone that I had in the house, and I was, you know, I had men in my house, so therefore I wasn't entitled to the single parent pension and that kind of thing. He was doing it that way, as well as physically by stalking me and chasing me in my car when I was dropping kids off at school, that kind of thing. And it was just
absolutely terrible. Absolutely terrible. So your dream of becoming a singer didn't happen. Can you tell us your career curve? What you've done in your life, Angelica?
Well, I gave up the singing. It was never a career, but I realised that I was actually better at writing. And the other thing that I knew that I began to explore was following the horrific death, and I don't know if England has ever heard, but there was a woman called Anita Coppi who was murdered in the most horrific way, gang raped and murdered by five people. And me always having been an empath and always feeling like I had to, you know, like pick up strays, if you want to call it that, and assist others and the downtrodden and the underdog, I wrote to her parents. And, you know, I mean, they received thousands upon thousands of letters, and yet they wrote back to me, and that we became friends. And through them, I started pursuing an interest in victims of crime. I became the only non-victim member of a very large victims of crime assistance group. And through that, I started to become interested in crime and punishment. And eventually that led me to becoming a juvenile justice officer frontline worker, where I actually worked with teenage and child detainees in prison. So that was basically what consolidated my real career, which was working with people in prison. And that took me into child protection after that. And then from that, I went into adult correction, working in a medium security men's prison.
And was that very fulfilling for you? I mean, after knowing how it feels to be trapped, knowing how it feels, you could feel empathy with the prisoners. I mean, you could be see both sides of the story, which must have been really good for them.
Absolutely. But the only time that was redeemed in its fullest form was when I was with the juveniles, because the juveniles were basically me when I was little. A lot of those juveniles had been mistreated, some horrifically, much worse than I was. I even considered myself lucky compared to some of those juveniles. That was my real love of the job. It wasn't the adult prison, because I realised the distinction between juveniles were still young enough to be malleable and they could be changed, and a lot of them were. Whereas the adults, they weren't. They'd already made up their mind, and that most adult prisoners, 80% of them are recidivists. They don't change. But the teenagers, they did, and I could see so much goodness in those children and so much potential for change that was the only job that I found fulfilling. I didn't last very long in the adult system. I only lasted 2 years, and then I moved into disabilities, which was the fourth area of community services that I've actually, you know, worked.
It sounds such a very fulfilling career, actually. So tell me about your next husband, and then also something went wrong and you tried to commit suicide quite recently. What's been happening?
This happened in 2014, so it wasn't that recent, thank goodness. But what happened was, and this is what I try and sort of paint an essence in the book, is that I fought from day one right up to when I met my second husband, and I met him in the prison system. He was a correctional officer, and I was the brand new correctional officer that had gone into this particular men's prison. I had fought for so many years for myself, for my self-esteem, to gain love, to gain acceptance, to establish myself in my own rights, that when I met Adam, who was so easygoing and so loving and so caring, that I stopped fighting. Yes. Because I'd finally found what I'd been looking for 44 years. That's when I met him.
Yeah.
He was actually 33. And then my mind, it's almost, this is what my psychologist told me, because I said to her, why now that I'm happy that I found someone that gives me love, that I don't have to fight for it, why am I collapsing? Why do I want to die? And she said, because you stopped fighting. Yeah. And when you stop fighting, your brain has to play catch up, and your brain just can't work anymore, and you become depressed. And it wasn't that I was suicidal. It was that I was so depressed without medication or therapy that I thought I wanted to die, but I actually didn't. But I thought I did, and I thought I was dragging my husband, he wasn't my husband at the time, down with me, and I didn't want him to go down with me because he was so wonderful that I wanted him to continue without me. So I thought the best option was for me to leave.
Terrible. So you've survived that, and how's the relationship going now?
The relationship is wonderful. We love each other implicitly and completely. However, the problems are still there. There's still the problems of my son. There's still problems that arise all the time, you know, with work and with just various little niggly things that probably aren't as big as they sound, but because they're constant, they're always testing us. But our relationship, I think, or I hope anyway, is not going to break, because we both really, really love each other, and we support each other, and especially him. He supports me regardless of how I feel. And also I'm quite well medicated. I do have therapy now, and that has taken the edge off the abyss. So I no longer feel like as much as I get upset and I feel victimized sometimes by my life, I don't go into that abyss where I can't get out anymore. I'm actually basically stamping out little fires all the time, but I don't fall into the quagmire.
Fantastic. So you had one hell of a life. You've had more than most people. At one point, you were homeless. If you read the book, it's a very long book. Everything's happened in it. What advice have you got to somebody who's feeling low out there now? What would you say to them?
I would say to them that if they have a belief system, and I'm not talking about Christian in particular, but if it is Christian, that's fine. But if they have a big belief system like I did, and I do speak about my metaphysical and spiritual belief system, explore that as much as you can, because when your mind doesn't want to work anymore, when it's tired and it just wants to give up, believing in something higher than yourself, that this is all temporary, that all of this will pass, that is a big saving grace. It was for me because, as you know in the book, I was quite a strict Catholic myself, or at least I tried to follow the dogma. But then when it didn't make sense for me anymore, I swapped it for metaphysics, which is a higher belief. It doesn't just encompass hell, heaven and purgatory. It encompasses other ethics and belief systems that give me that constant reassurance that this is not all there is, that there is more, and that I'm not to blame, and even other people are not to blame, that they're all characters on a stage that are there to aggrandize your character, to make it bigger, to make it stronger. And if you start to believe that everything that happens to you is a chain of events for a moral lesson to give you a larger character and more strength to help not only yourself but others as well, then you're not going to give in. You won't give in to any of that pain, because it's all, you know, you're just a little microcosm in a massive macrocosm that needs you.
Fantastic. So how's it been response to the book?
At this point, because self-published in England and I've paid for the marketing package to be, you know, for them to, for Matador and Troubadour to actually, you know, get me out there in England, there is a little bit of response over there in Europe. However, here in Australia, I'm trying very, very hard to market myself as an Australian author so that someone can pick me up and, you know, actually show the book in my own country. So this, at the moment, it's all in its inception. So I've basically got to sit back and try and see how far it goes. So I don't know how well it's going per se, but I've already sold all the copies that I had freighted from England, which were 130, and I'm doing my book launch on Thursday here in the Barossa Valley, which is one country, for anyone who doesn't know, in South Australia. And I've just got to keep plugging at it and, you know, getting my name out there. Thank you very much, Josephine, for being a part of that. I hope your listeners want to buy my book. But that's all I can tell you at this stage. I don't know how well it's going to go. I hope it goes really well.
Well, so do I. And I think I feel emotional when I say this, because I honestly think you're a very brave woman. And what the best thing about your life is that you, even though you say every day is difficult, which we must accept that, we're never going to get to this. There's no such thing as a perfect life. Life is up and down. If we accept the ups and downs and have hope, we can have a good time on this earth. And thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much. You've actually given me a warm-up, my book launch.
Great. 70,000 Camels, A Motivational Survivor's Memoir Guide by Angelica A. Brewer is published by Matador. This is Radio Gorgeous. Thanks for listening. Radio Gorgeous, podcasts for women.